Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Get It Off Your Breasts, the podcast that digs into the issues that are really getting under your skin. This week we are absolutely delighted to be joined by comedian Sarah Pascoe. Hello Sarah.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we will be discussing over the next hour or so sexual accusations, people buying followers on social media, and the pray for hashtags. So a whole wide variety there of topics to dig into. And Sarah, as our guest, yes, as our honoured guest, yeah, do you want to tell us first what you'd like to get off your breasts this week?
Well, I think like lots of people, like everyone, there's suddenly such a flurry of discussion about sexual assaults, the abuse of power by men to women or men to other men. And also lots of us trying to work out how to make sure these kind of things don't keep happening. But I think the trouble as well, and it's in terms of the flurry that's come straight out of the Harvey Weinstein thing, is how to do it in a really responsible way. Because an irresponsible way is to just say, I heard so-and-so did this, and my friend said so-and-so, or I've always felt a bit weird about that person. So it also feels like this thing that there's this massive opportunity to do something positive, but also some really terrible things could come out of it in the same sense, because, you know, you can ruin someone's career with the wrong rumour. Like, and once something's been said, you can't take it back. So it's really difficult without, because not everything can ever be kind of criminally charged or people don't want to come forward. I feel like it's a really potentially positive time, but also it feels really messy.
You've got the situation where you really want to believe women.
Yeah, to support women, and definitely.
And men who come forward with accusations, yeah, and to make people feel that if they do have the courage to come forward, yeah, and share their stories, that they're not going to be accused of making things up.
What I feel like is, like, there has to be a way of supporting, number one, the person who underwent something. And there's a whole spectrum of whether that's a man, like one of my friends the other day at a corporate gig, a man squeezed her bottom, which is something absolutely everyone would have experienced since she was a child. So there's like that kind of thing to much more severe things. But I just feel like naming people on Facebook isn't the way forward.
Mm. Yeah, I saw that there was a Google Doc that was being shared, yeah, amongst female journalists recently, and I think it got taken down. In a private Facebook group, is that better? Or is it the fact, yeah, that it was a Google Doc that was public?
Yeah.
I don't know how I felt about
it's
that.
It's very, very unsettling. And so very similarly with the female comedian, someone sent around an anonymous email saying, I mean, because technically we have a union, and they haven't gone to the union, and the union's failed. They've just assumed no one cares, no one's doing anything. The difficulty with our career is that probably like lots of people who are self-employed, at the very beginning you're reliant on really good working relationships, and sometimes those really good working relationships are with just men who run gigs in above or below pubs. And so the very, very vulnerable people are usually young women travelling on their own, staying over in people's spare rooms, having to have a drink with him afterwards and be friendly so he'll book her again for a paid slot. So the people, everyone's got stories like that, but there are some instances that are more extreme. But I do think we have to go through, we have to set up a structural way of dealing with those things. Because often then what happens is 10 years later, you're a much more empowered person who doesn't need to play that gig anymore. Now you want to go on Facebook, this man did this thing. But I feel like it has to be really responsibly done.
Well, that you I mean,
depending what we want the outcome to be, which is no other women to have that experience.
Yes, yeah. But then the argument is also like, what, men shouldn't be doing it full stop.
Yeah.
And so that's like the whole thing about, like, even like the Jimmy Savile thing, a lot of people were like, it was different back then,
yeah,
don't dig up the past. And it's like that is such a weird thing to say.
Well, Harvey Weinstein tried to say that, didn't he? Said it, you know, it was a 60s, yeah, 70s culture,
yeah,
and things were different back then. But I think one of the first steps towards achieving what you're talking about is to have education and to have a very clear knowledge, both for women and for men, of what crosses a line from, for example, someone who thinks they're flirting or just thinks, I'm trying, you know, I'm just trying it on with someone a little bit like you would, and crossing a line to actually being either harassment or assault.
Or making someone feel intimidated, because I think what, there was a really interesting podcast, a radio DJ in Australia was going around King's Cross in Sydney, and she was dressed in a short skirt and a t-shirt, and every time a man shouted at her, she interviewed him about why he'd done it, and what was really interesting is what she kept coming up with is they were describing what they were doing as fun and a bit of flirtation, and the women smile and laugh at us, and she goes, do you understand that that's what we do when we're scared? And she had this discussion with a man. It was so fascinating because he said that you're just talking about you, that's not all women. And she was saying, can I describe to you what it's like when a man shouts at me or touches me without my permission? And he was saying, I think you've had a really bad life, I think it's actually a really good laugh.
Because there's
they don't understand.
Called Daisy Buchanan, who wrote this piece for The Guardian, I think it was called Why I'm Frustrated at How I Need to Be Nice to Creepy Men. Because you're right, that is the reaction when you're scared to laugh it off. Like, there's this horrible video, like, literally you want to rip your skin off watching it on Twitter at the moment. Howard Stern interviewing Emma Bunton, like, years and years ago, and he's like, when did you start your period? When did you lose your virginity?
Howard Stern does that.
Like,
though,
are you wearing any pants right now? Yeah. And she's laughing. And loads of comments underneath were from men going, oh my God, I've listened to this loads of times. I thought it was fine. But watching her squirm like that is a different story.
Yeah, there's also a real level of embarrassment. So I said this to you guys before we started recording, but I haven't actually said this publicly. And I think pretty much every woman we know has a story. But since the Harvey Weinstein sort of all the cases came to light, I tried to like count how many times I've been sexually assaulted in various degrees of seriousness. I think it was 6 times. And if I look at like the two probably the most serious ones, one was a doctor and one was my boss. And in both those times, I look back now, and I was obviously younger, I was between the ages of like 18 and 22, but which played into why you don't sort of stand up for yourself sending. But it's also like you're really embarrassed. And you're really embarrassed, not only at the time you're embarrassed to say anything, you're also embarrassed to like be the person to be seen to making a fuss.
It's
and
so
like not being the cool chick who's like...
But also it almost feels arrogant. Like experiences I had when I was younger, I felt, you know, like we were talking actually before we started recording about the people who respond going, no one would want to rape you. That misunderstanding. Some of the time my problem was, or the reason I would let something maybe go too far is because to say to someone it's not appropriate what you're doing would then to be acknowledged, and then they go, I'm not, like, you see what I mean? There's so, but it's really interesting because I'm like studying and trying to learn about the brain and how the brain reacts when you're scared, especially for women, is that the amygdala takes over and basically makes a decision, which is quite imprisoning. I think everyone's had an experience, like my most recent one was on public transport, and again, as an adult, absolutely, I feel like I'm so much more like shouty and confident than I could. But in this actual instant, a man put his hand up my skirt and inside my knickers, which is so common. Like, they, as in, like, we all know that that happens on public transport, but nothing's happened to me for a really long time, like since I was in school uniform. And I just froze. And that's the thing, it's like I'm in my fucking 30s now. And again, that's victim, you literally victim blame yourself, because you then go home and you go, I didn't shout on the train, I didn't go that mad, is it? He apologised to me as well, he knows what he did, and then he went, sorry.
Like, really?
Yeah. Because it's just like as everyone was kind of piling onto the train, which is, so it's obviously something he does all the time. And it was so strange, but I had such a physiological reaction.
For me, I also found, which is a really weird and like complicated thought, but it's that you actually end up empathising and feeling a bit sorry for the guy. And I know that's like, I don't when it's at someone else. No. So for example, with Harvey Weinstein's case, the extreme of Jimmy Savile, you just go, oof, no sympathy. But when it happens to me, I ended up thinking like, oh God, but like this guy has a family, and like, oh, maybe he's just like a bit lonely and a bit like depraved.
And you go, what signals was I giving out? Like, we do the victim blame.
And I just think I don't want
to
ruin his life, and oh God.
But I think it's because a lot of the confusion comes because we want the world to be a nice place. People who deny what women are talking about a lot at the moment is that these things are happening to everyone, and it has to stop, and it has to be better. And there's another generation of women growing up, and they shouldn't have to part with this. But the people who are saying it's not that bad, it's because they don't want to believe the world is this bad. And I think it's similarly when something happens, you want it to be a mistake or a one-off, because otherwise the world is a much worse place than you thought it was.
I also think that like so many problems in the world do link back to this like toxic masculinity thing. Like, I don't know if you've read Grace and Perry's book, but it's, I know what you mean about the feeling sorry for men, because they Well, I think they are like led down this path of this is what you have to be like, and like with Robert Webb's book about masculinity, and it's
men who are predators manipulate that too. Yes. So with the case of my boss, for example, when it happened, he was doing this whole like, oh, go on, you make an old man so happy.
Oh,
like,
gosh.
And it kind of, and it made me feel a bit sorry for him. Yeah. Like, oh God, I don't, like, I shouldn't go into too much detail. But then the next, so basically what happened is I fell asleep fully clothed on this bed.
Yeah.
And when I woke up, he had his hand inside my bra. And I literally just ran out of the room.
Yeah.
And I went to a meeting and I was sitting there and I was obviously quite my God. And he walked in, and in front of about eight people in like a meeting, he walked up to me and went, you left your earrings in my hotel room last night and put them on the table in front of me. And so that made me just go straight away, like, that was like, I shouldn't have fallen asleep on that bed. Like, even that,
well, this is the thing about people. This is the thing about people who take pictures of people. So what they do, and again, it's to manipulate you or the victim, the person. If you're passed out or you've drunk too much, and what they do is they take off a piece of clothing, take a picture of you, and then they can use that to bribe you.
Shaming you.
And all of those things. So, but that's what he literally did with those earrings, is I want them to think, and I want you to know that you had a choice.
That is really
how do we it's about how we talk to children, because I think that's what's, so with girls and boys, like, I've always think, if you have like empathy-led sex education, if boys when they're 11 or 12 got to hear from girls from another school talking about what it's like to be in school uniform, be flashed at, or have men bibbing their horn from a lorry and laughing at you, I think if they heard that, I don't think they'd become men who did that. I think this is, and I think, but I do also think that men, and this isn't sympathy, this is an acknowledgement of gender construct, they are given much more confusing messages than women are given. Women are giving some really unhealthy messages that we are trying to outgrow and change, but men are told this real mix of, like, men are only safe if they're macho. Still, like, the biggest insult with schoolboys is calling each other gay. Like, there's things that are really, really problematic. You're telling men they have to be really strong to stick up for themselves, to protect women, but also at the same time, I don't think they understand the difference between, like, peacocking and how to be respectful. And I think, I don't think they know. And, you know, like, have you had this online? I've had so many men contacting me going, why do women only go for bad boys? Like, and they think it's a real thing, whereas I don't think that's true. In my experience, it's not true.
I think, like, some women do, and it depends on your experience.
Yeah, like, my definition of, like, a real man is definitely, like, a real man to me is someone who, like, believes in gender equality and is nice.
Yeah. But I think people who do go for bad boys, because I'm slightly guilty of that. A little bit. Not necessarily bad boys, but maybe slightly dangerous boys. But I think, like, or ones that, you know, I think it's also that slight thing of, like, I can help this person and save this person and fix this person, which is not particularly healthy.
I think a troubled person, I think their idea of a bad boy is like someone
on a motorbike.
There's been a couple of, like, spree killers, but were young men, and their anger was, like, do you remember this boy? He was 2 years ago, I think, in America, and the video he made beforehand is because he was so angry that none of the girls would sleep with him. And he was like, I'm so nice, I'm so this. And he was so furious that he couldn't lose his virginity, and all these slags were giving it away to these other men who don't deserve them. There's this entitlement that men are taught about sex, and especially now from pornography, that they find really confusing, because whether it's aggressive or not, all porn tells them that women are receptive and up for it and really enjoy this kind of thrusting sex, but they don't have any other narrative to balance it with as
an
adult should have.
So does it start with schools and, you know, parents, and actually trying to educate, like, girls about what the, you know, about their own bodies and how much, you know, respecting their own bodies and not feeling that they have to compromise that in any way, and boys, and about what is the line to cross.
I think girls, it's getting better. I think girls are taught a lot more about autonomy. I think probably, like, all of us, we engage with teenage girls. I'm so impressed. I'm so like, oh, they're so on it. I went to a school in Peckham, and the reason they were having the Great Men Initiative went in to do a workshop with them, that's volunteer men who work with boys about masculinity, which I think is such an amazing thing. But the reason is because the girls from years sort of 10 and 11 wrote an open letter to their headmaster saying someone needs to talk to the boys about pornography. Like, you can't expect us to deal with this.
Did you see recently there was a fire, I think it was a firefighting commissioner in a village, and he was suspended, and it was a female firefighter, and she basically said that they started showing pornography. She was the only female firefighter, and they started showing pornography at the end, like thinking it was funny and saying things like, "Oh yeah, we jizzed in your balaclava," and all sorts of things like that. And she reported it, and the guy ended up resigning, and 20 other male firefighters resigned in like protest. And now she says she can't walk around; she gets like coffee thrown in her face, and she's become like really vilified for being like, you know,
because she didn't see the joke.
Ruined this guy's life. Yeah, you ruined this guy's life, and it was just boys.
Yeah,
you know, boys having a laugh, and you know, I once worked
at a pub in Brentwood, so I was 18, and the pub was running to a police station. The police would come in, and often I'd be working on my own, and they would have called it all banter, but and some of it I really liked. Like, I actually quite like hearing about like dead bodies and stuff. Like, I liked their stories, but sometimes they would be really flirty. Like, would you do this? And if I was there, would you do that? And I had one shift where I did that thing. You know, when you feel physically sick, where I was doing the fake laughing. And then I complained about them, and then I couldn't work at that pub anymore.
Oh my god, the fake laughing brings back so many memories. That's why watching Emma Bunton squirm
like, and it's a public transport thing. This is the thing, and I think men would never ever have had it. If you dare, like, as a child, I loved reading so much, but I couldn't read at a bus stop because it meant a weird man could come over and sit down next to me. What are you reading? Whenever I've opened a book in public, it literally, another man now has a chat up line, a way in.
Oh my god. I know, because I love going and sitting in a cafe with a book and maybe even like, you know, get a little drink if it's like, you know, past 5 p.m. or something. And then, apparently that's an invitation to like, hi, oh, you're drinking on your own.
But again, I think the media lies. I think they think that a woman on a bar stool is like, I'm a sex worker, free but I'm free. All. Yeah.
But so what do we do then? Because back to kind of your original point that you were saying, like, how do we get that balance right whereby women feel that they can come out and say when they've been assaulted or harassed? What do we do in terms of evidence? I think
so one side is maybe sometimes we want to talk about stuff because we want the support. So it's not about I need that person to life to be ruined. So I think the law change is very interesting. So you know that it's always been that a victim in a rape case has her anonymity, and is supposed to have her anonymity. Well, now the law is that the person she is accused has their anonymity as well. Now, it's really complicated.
And it's changed.
Yeah, so I thought this is really fantastic because all the people who always, and it's obviously a very, very small percentage of people who have false accusations, but I thought, how great, because no one can ever be challenge saying, well, you're just trying to ruin his life, or now his marriage is over. It's like, no, he's got his anonymity. Nobody need know about this. But then apparently the reason the anonymity is bad is because quite often victims come forward when someone else accuses them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so it's really tricky.
But for example, like, I never named and shamed what happened to me, but if I saw someone else now doing it, I probably would come forward to back them up, because you feel braver, but you feel like you're not carrying the weight of ruining their life, and also you want to support that woman.
I think having a plan for next time, this is the really tricky thing, especially when stuff is really historical. I feel like the first thing is support that person. If they're coming forward, no matter what they need, and as we all know, there's not that much, but maybe as a community, first thing is supporting people who have gone through traumatic things and making them stronger, but then also having a working kind of strategy in place. So now what do we do when that happens? How do we deal with the hand on the leg? How do we deal with the saying slightly inappropriate things, but all of these different ways, but within safety and parameters? And are there organizations we can talk to, like, okay, it's my boss, but it's this, and I don't want to make it worse, and the other thing is, like, and this is what's so horrible about when people are horrible to people who don't speak out, is everyone knows what it's like when it will literally affect your livelihood.
That's the worst.
And we're all so disposable, all of us, men and women. But the minute you're a troublemaker, it might not be that day, but later 3 months' time. Yeah.
There's also a real authority thing. So it is this idea of people who are in positions of power, which was really clear with the Harvey Weinstein, and especially when you hear that awful tape where he's chilling. And, you know, if you look at like a boss, or I had another case with a doctor, and again, it's someone that you're meant to trust, and it's a position of authority, and you don't want to challenge those people because you feel like you're going to just look like a total idiot. And actually, what's really weird about medical, so talking about the whole evidence side, I did try and report the doctor. He basically took his gloves off during an internal exam, hand the rock the cradle style. And I was 18, so I just was like freaking out.
Yeah.
Anyway, I tried to report it, and I went to the doctor. And did you know, so if your doctor, something like that happens, you have to write a personal letter to that doctor telling him what you think happened. Then he has to write a personal letter back to you explaining his actions.
And only then, if you don't accept it, can it go forward. And when you've gone through something like that, you don't want any contact with that person. And I think kinds of things do need to change.
Well, actually, it's like when you have the NHS doesn't have a complaints procedure at all. So that's the thing. Mm. That's what that is. That's not a complaints procedure. There isn't someone else going, okay, we'll take this on board. They do that to protect themselves.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's such a weird culture we live in when you think it's normal when they're like, do you want a female or a male masseuse on your spa break? Mm. And you're like, why is that even a question? But I'd definitely say female, please. Yeah.
But all these things that we're talking about as well, they're not just to protect women, they're also to protect men. Yes. Like, you know, a doctor having a female present when they do an exam, or, you know, a guy knowing very, very clearly what is the line between, you know, just trying on and actually abusing their power or harassing
them. There's a really amazing, in Juno Dawson's book, there's something so incredible. So before she transitioned, she had an experience with on a date with a very, very pushy man. And it reads like any of the stories that all of us would have had in terms of, and it's the first time I've really read a fantastic description of a man also feeling that thing where you're slightly powerless when they're that much bigger than you. Mm-hmm. And that's the fear thing of like trying to get away from it, but knowing you literally can't throw them off you.
No. That awareness. And like when Leah Seydoud wrote that piece about Harvey Weinstein, she really does say like he's a big guy.
Yeah, he can throw you for a wall.
He's a big guy physically, and then add to that the power, the influence, your entire career, and also all these other factors we've talked about. And it wasn't just women; there were men who admitting now that they were told. I think Colin Firth has admitted and said how ashamed he is that he was told by a woman, and they don't have the it in them to go and expose that either because it's that kind of just pressure and the power of someone like that, and adds to the physical presence. You just can't even imagine.
Good thing, I do think. And I don't know if you agree with this, but I'm an optimistic person, but I feel like the tide has changed. I do feel like this is marking a bit of a change because we've got these like A-listers, whatever, who are publicly speaking out. And I just think this has never happened before, has it?
No.
Where people have
With the Jimmy Savile thing, and they were like, this cannot happen again. I think there's a couple of still high status people that you wouldn't leave your sister in a room alone with.
Mm. And people don't know about you.
I think
Donald fucking Trump.
Yeah, Donald Trump is
there's loads of videos.
Well, that's it.
The rest of these
guys. Naomi Wolf's thing about Donald Trump was really interesting. So in her book, she talks about how that you would think that would lose a president election, grab her by the pussy, but because it was a sign of power and he's trying to be a powerful politician. And she said, there's so many disenfranchised men in America. They were like, he's doing the thing that all of us want to be allowed to do. He gets, and that's why it wasn't an election losing thing.
But don't you think also it was that they said, well, he wouldn't actually act on that. He was just saying it as to show off and bants. I just want to ask you actually, Sarah, and you absolutely don't have to answer this, but I was just interested because obviously there was a bit of furore because James Corden made some jokes about Harvey Weinstein. Yeah. And a lot of people were saying by doing that, it's almost like taking away what these women have gone through. And
I thought he was in a lose-lose situation, James Corden.
So
I think James Corden is already quite an unpopular figure in the UK. So already he was damned if he did and damned if he doesn't. He is, we all know, a very, very funny person, but he didn't have very... Look, do you know what? It wasn't Chris Rock at the Oscars. He didn't get that chance to go, right, here you are, we've spent a week with the best writers in the country and we're on point, morally correct and hysterical. So it's just cheap jokes. Mm. If they'd been really, really funny and they'd felt empowering, then it would have been so fantastic. And I imagine in 2 days they would have been.
Do you think it's too soon as well?
No, I think really good jokes. I just don't think they were funny.
But it also felt like
they didn't make logical sense. He was going, Harvey Weinstein would, tonight's so beautiful, Harvey Weinstein would take it out. And you go, but I think
and then the bit where he says, if you don't like it, you better leave.
He couldn't come in a plant pot. It was just they weren't very good jokes.
But that whole thing, like the whole Donald Trump defense when he got caught on tape talking about grabbing women by the pussy, and he said, well, that's locker room talk and blah, blah, blah. And I felt like, in a way, by what James Corden was doing, like obviously he's not doing anything like what Donald Trump's doing, but he was reducing these assaults to
punchline.
Just
as if he had said, I don't believe, and most people don't believe, James Corden is shocked by these allegations. I don't think he's cried about it. I don't think...
They're friends, aren't they?
I don't think he feels weird. I don't think he's... So he's not the kind of person. If he'd come out and he did swear, it's weird to be doing a show tonight. It's weird to be making jokes about Hollywood because sometimes it's turned upside down and all of us had the blinkers off and to find out it's this many people and it's that horrible. And I just want to have it a second to say how brave everyone is and how I know that you have our support in this room, and everyone would have clapped. And then he'd gone, and we did, I did invite Harvey Weinstein here tonight to see this, but he couldn't come.
There I'm nominating you to host the Oscars.
No, but that's like, if he said that, he'd have got round applause. Yeah. Then his joke would have been applicable. Because the other thing was that all of the, they were saying none of these guys is, I reckon James Corden would have been in the back of a car. All of the night show hosts haven't dealt with Harvey Weinstein yet. I've got a gig tonight. I'm going to open with them. So let's just write some jokes in the car. And he won't have written those jokes. So I just think it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't. But I do think all of those people, that's what they should be saying. But they're so scared because, yeah.
Mm.
Because they will all, if he, yeah, they are all risking upsetting other very powerful people connected.
Mm. God, that's interesting. Yeah, he should have done what you said. Like, that would have been way better.
Yeah.
And also, it probably would have, if someone's going to make a joke about it, in a way, it should be a female comedian. I don't think it's the right person.
I think it's strong. But no, but I still think it's strong for a man to say, "I'm disgusted."
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like, I am as a human being disgusted that my the people I work with work in a different world to me, and sometimes I don't realise, and that's why they call it male privilege, and that's why it's called white privilege, and that's why these things exist, and it's good to be reminded. And crazy.
Also, I didn't realise how many people didn't like James Corden because it was like a public shaming fest.
Yeah, but that's why we're down to do
pictures of him and Harvey Weinstein together hugging. Yeah. Pictures of him from the videos of him from the Glamour Awards back in the day.
But then, to be fair, there's photos of everyone having Harvey Weinstein, including the women who've accused him and who he's admitted to assaulting. Because
he was at parties, and there's always, as you know, those people are always circling round. And you fake smile, or you just by the person. Yeah.
Also, did you see that little clip that went viral of Courtney
Love? Oh, that was quite
at the
unbelievable.
Roast. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. I just on James Corden, it's a tall poppy syndrome. I think it's I think it's unfortunate because he is damned whatever he does.
Mm-hmm. Gosh.
Wow.
We could talk about this for the whole hour.
Also, this is the importance of talking about stuff in real life, not on Twitter. Because I never join in stuff because I feel like it's so short, and then it sounds like you're angrier than you are. With so much stuff, it's like, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. I just wish it wasn't all today. All I wanted is like to put all of the women in the world in my womb. just get them all in there.
We're getting very full in there, Sarah.
Yeah, it's like, okay, you're all in there now.
This podcast should just be called like, we don't know.
We don't know.
We don't have a clue.
We'll talk about it anyway.
I think changing tact completely, a little bit more lighthearted. Mm. Fake people on social media, essentially.
Yeah.
So I've discovered this app / website, and listeners, feel free to check it out. But it's called Social Blade. Mm-hmm. And essentially, you can go on it, and it's meant to be there so that you can see how many followers you've got, because you know on Instagram it's just like K, if you've got thousands of followers.
Yeah.
It just rounds it up.
Yeah.
So it's meant to be for like social media professionals.
So you can find out to the exact 32.
Yeah, exactly. Like owner 31.
Yeah.
And also how many followers you're getting per day, if you care. And so you can monitor like what's successful and what's not successful. And I find it quite useful actually, except for when I'm like lost 10 followers today.
The one thing you don't want to do is get so far down the tunnel of you're manipulating it for an extra 2 followers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't think people unfollow sometimes when it's too like family orientated. But anyway, on this app you can find out if people are buying followers, and because you can see like a massive spike, and also you can see if people like go on a massive following spree and then unfollow everyone.
But then what if, for example, so like sometimes something happens, and this is going to sound really name droppy, but like a member of a boy band followed me, and because of that, like I got a mass. Like I got.
Oh
like,
yeah, yes. No, it yeah. takes into
so,
account.
So what if like you're just someone who like, or like for example, something happened. You were on TV one day, and then suddenly you got a spike.
Sounds like you've got a lot of excuses for your spike.
I'm just wondering because I feel like this is gonna like people are gonna start now like all excusing each other of stuff, and someone's like, I just did a really cool radio show, I don't know.
Well, no, it's more. You definitely get spikes, and. And that, you can understand why, but it basically shows if someone is mass following, I don't know, like, Turkish accounts. Do you know what I mean?
With the fake followers then, so I don't even understand that. So do people, what are they?
So you buy bots.
Yeah, and they're just bots, so people just start them all up so they can sell them to other people.
Oh, you buy bots. I thought you bought real people.
I don't really know.
So computer programs can start accounts, can't they? Because that's why everything says tick if you're not a robot. And you think,
oh. But I think what it is on this app is you can see. So for example, if tonight you went on the app and you saw that I just followed 5,000 people from another country, who have like usernames,
that would be a thing that you'd pay to do,
and so then I would then unfollow those 5,000 people next week, but then like those people would follow me back.
Okay.
And there's been quite a lot of sort of pop stars and people like that who've been accused of buying like a million followers.
And why do they do that? So the purpose for doing it then is what? Advertising.
So there was a documentary a while ago called like Click Farm, I think it was called, and it was big brands who would make a Facebook page. Say for example, like a new company, they would buy like 3 million fans, Facebook fans, all people just like clicking through. Like an agency where they would set up fake accounts and follow, and then basically as a consumer you would go, oh, what's this? Oh, it's got 3 million fans, I better follow it. And so then you'd start
organic, but also producers these days and like commissioners, they do look at your followers. So for example, if you go to a meeting to pitch someone, they'll sometimes, I've been asked, well, how many followers have you got? So I actually think like it's actually like there's a lot of pressure on people, especially if you're trying to make your way up, there's a lot of pressure to appear to be popular perhaps before you've had a chance to really prove
yourself. Also, with the other media's suffering because of online, so like with TV, they do really care about online stuff, and that's why they keep trying to put YouTubers in TV programmes, because they think that people are going to suddenly start watching television again.
Even people like, I think... If I've got the people wrong, then excuse me, sorry, don't want to libel anyone, but I think like Katy Perry, Justin Bieber, like even people that are already hugely popular, they saw they had bought like a couple of million or something like that. Yeah.
Really?
And they obviously just wanted to look like, it's like the more popular you look, like that breeds more fans, like you were saying. Yeah. So then you'll get more, and the record companies will like push it more, and then you'll get more people thinking like, oh, I should, you know, this is the popular. Well, they're also competing against each other.
Yeah, of course, and that's obviously, if you've got Lady Gaga, you're going to be 10 million behind.
Yeah. But there was an example of it a while ago. Essentially, this person had bought like 100,000 followers or done this bot follow thing, which I haven't explained very well, but whatever. This company, this shoe brand, like really well-known shoe brand, like basically put her on a billboard, like on Times Square, being like this amazing influencer on Instagram. Yeah. And then it came out that she had fake followers, and that brand has spent like loads of money on her.
But in a way, I think good for her. Yeah. Like part of me thinks you know what, she's competing in a world where everyone's so obsessed with online following, and she's just like, she's used her initiative and her nous to go, you know what, I'm going to make this happen for me, and I'm going to, you know, I haven't got those followers, I'm going to do it and be a bit savvy. And in a way, I sort of think like, high five to you, you've like pulled one over on that brand.
But then,
and you've done it,
then who's the loser in the end though? Because then they find out she's got fake followers, and then no one trusts her in the industry.
But she's still
ever again
got those shoes.
I think maybe because I really believe in like kind of slow and steady wins the race. Like I think you should like build up a real group of people, whether that's like 200 people or 10 people or 2,000 people.
I think that's the thing about it, chasing it like a numbers game. And this is why I'm glad none of these things existed when I was at school. I was very unpopular at school. This is the kind of thing that would have really bothered me. If people didn't want to be my online friend, I'd have been very aware of that. And I think that must be very hard. And then I think... and then you imagine that slippery slope, and you get a dopamine hit when you get any when you hit any target, you get a dopamine hit in your brain, and it's really wonderful, and obviously it's a pleasure circuitry, and stuff online sets it off all the time. It's things like new followers, getting
likes,
when you have when suddenly a tweet's been retweeted a lot, and for all of us that's a different amount, but you can't help being like, oh, I'm having a blowing up online today. You can't help it, and that's dopamine. And that's the other side of it, is you feel like you don't want these people wasting their lives away checking numbers and...
But that's the thing. So, Emma, I kind of like, in a way, I do... I agree with you on what you're saying about it's not great and, you know, it's disingenuous, but I don't think the individuals doing it are the ones to blame, if that makes sense. I think, like, the pressure on them to look popular. And whether it's, like, you know, a young person who wants to just look like they've got loads of mates, or it's someone who's trying to, like... get a record label to actually pay attention to their single and therefore wants to look like they've got loads of followers. Exactly. Don't hit the plate of the head. Yeah.
I know, that's it. So, yeah, I forgive that. I understand the reason for doing it. You know, like how monkeys make themselves look much bigger and they're like in the bush to scare off the other monkeys. Like, you kind of feel like a bit sorry for them, like, okay, you have to pretend you're this guy. But maybe that's the world that we live in now.
Yeah. What's going to happen, Emma? Are they going to like do like a list, like a name and shame list then? Like,
I think that the industries are going to wise up to it and like, you know, I'm sat at home on this app, like, you know, festering in my anger. But like, you know, like you say, people are allowing these people to exist with their fake lives online. And, you know, for example, I do quite a lot of travel writing. I feel very privileged that I get to do that. And then these PR companies from big travel, luxury travel brands are like, oh, let's send that girl to go and stay for free for 10 days in this wellness retreat where she's gone and bought loads of followers.
Yeah.
You know, that company are losing their money until they wake up to it. Like, we shouldn't really care.
So isn't that the same, though, as back in the day, like before we had online media? Do you remember the episode of Sex and the City and Samantha decided to launch her boyfriend? He was like an actor and he was in some like shitty little fringe play, and she decided to like make a fake buzz around him, and she was like, I'm going to make you a famous actor. And so she basically got like fake paparazzi to come down, like put a red carpet, like, and basically kind of act as if he was already famous. And because of that, then the press were like, who's this guy? So in a way, isn't like doing that with the followers, isn't that the kind of like modern way of faking the kind of, and doing like that, you know? I mean, I've heard of a few people doing it where they pay like fake paparazzi to come and like when they walk to a club, like go and then the other paps go, oh, who's that? And then it kind of spreads like wildfire.
When they used to have, actually sell cassettes and records, they were people on motorbikes who went around to all of the record shops and bought them, so people went to number one. Like, that was how people used to chart in music.
And the art world, they do it in the art world. They buy each other's artwork and they push the price up.
I hear things about the publishing industry as well, like, you know, someone will buy the top spot on the charts.
Not books as well.
Oh god. The world is fake. So forget fake news, it's fake books.
So essentially what you're saying is like buying your followers to give you a little boost, and then maybe that might turn into something organic is actually just doing a bit of a Samantha Jones.
I know someone and I won't name and shame them. And the only person I know that's done this, who she had a short stand-up clip, and she paid a company that helped you make it go viral, and it did go viral, and it was a brilliant clip.
I got approached because I did a TEDx talk and it had like 2 views. Literally like no one watched it. I was like, okay, because on the TEDx channel, which has 7 million followers, because they put so many up a day, it doesn't go to those 7 million like algorithm. So I was like, oh great, like 71 views a month in. And this woman emailed me. She was like, hi, I just saw your TEDx talk, really enjoyed it. Basically my company can make that have millions of hits. Are you interested? And I deleted it. So because I just feel like the way I see this is, fair game, buy yourself some followers, blah blah blah, but I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. Like, I want to know that every single person who has enjoyed my work
There's in The Fountainhead, which I know is obviously a very right-wing book, but what she says is really fantastic, that there's two kinds of architect, but I think it goes for anything creative. She's like, there's the kind of person who wants everyone to know that they built the building, and there's the kind of person who just wants to build their design and they don't care if someone else takes the credit, but they needed to make the thing. And I think that's the thing, is we do what we do because the process is so enjoyable, not the whole...
for the credit.
But no, thanks, guys. That's made me think of it in a slightly three-dimensional way, because I just thought it was, you know, wrong.
I think it's easier when it's not quite your industry in the same way.
So what I wanted to get off my breast, also in the online world, but a slightly different angle, and this kind of annoys me, but maybe you guys will also throw some light on this and make me feel better about it. Whenever there's a disaster, whether it's a natural disaster or a terrorist attack, and people jump online and do the hashtag pray for, so pray for London, pray for Berlin, pray for Paris, and I just find like, there's so many things about it that bother me. Like, firstly, I feel like not everyone is religious in this world, and the whole, like, the fact that you have to, the way to show you care is to do the pray for. Secondly, I feel like as someone who is in that kind of moment of the disaster, and whether you've lost a loved one or you're injured or whatever else, like, do you really want people to pray for you, or do you want them to take action? And I think by writing pray for, you almost like let yourself off the hook and go, I've done my bit, I've shown I care to the world. And actually, rather than putting a pray for Portugal or whatever else, like, try and actively find an organisation on the ground who you can support, who you can, if you can't, you know, donate money yourself. Maybe you can tweet to your followers and let them know. Or maybe you can volunteer. For example, with Grenfell, like, don't pray for Grenfell, go down, volunteer, like, find a way to help. And I just think it lets people off the hook in that way. And also, like, the third thing that annoys me about it is I feel it kind of creates, like, a hierarchy of... like tragedies. So for example, like, often when it's something that happens, for example, like in Pakistan or in Somalia, as it happened recently, it will be like not trending as pray for it. But when it's in like Europe, so when it's like one of our neighbours, and you know, you understand that in a way, because like when it's close to you, it kind of hits home.
People, but people can't help but empathise. Like, if it happens in New York, it's like, it could have been me. They're just like me.
Absolutely,
and people don't have that.
I do get that, and I do understand that, and I think it's like a really natural. Like, if it happens like around the corner for me, I would.
But it's still a thing to note, to go, even those of us who don't consider ourselves racist have selective empathy. Like, even so, I think it's really good to be aware of it,
because if someone looks, it's not just how close they are, it's also if they look like you.
It's also if you've been there on holiday. It's also if it's the kind of place. All of these things factor in.
If they speak English, like, I think Australia's really far, but we'd probably be more shocked. But I think the whole pray for hashtag does sort of really highlight and sort of make transparent how that there is that hierarchy of what we were saying of like neighbouring tragedies.
My dad always used to say about, so my mom is an empath, right? And my mom, because I think some people, this is one tiny thing I'd say, some people would put the hashtag pray for you and also do something. It isn't for everyone, but I know what you mean, that thing about I've done my bit, pat on the back, because I think it's much more about being seen to care than it is about caring. But other people would go, this, I can't understand how this happened at Grenfell in London in this day and age. Pray for everyone involved, and then they could still do things. It wouldn't be like full stop, solved. But my mum's always really cried at the news, right? So my mum is someone who feels the world's pain. She feels it, and it's genuine. And whether it's babies or whatever it is, the world. My dad, who's a much colder person, and he used to hate it, and he used to go, when people cry, they're always crying for themselves. They're not crying for people. Like, and he said, and then my dad said, it's cathartic. When your mum cries about the babies in Africa, and then she gets up, she goes to bed, nothing's done. And that's what his problem is. Like, you shouldn't feel better.
But you know what? I have to say, like, there's something I agree in that.
No,
like,
that's what I mean. There is something.
When I went to Calais with a charity that I co-founded, and when we first turned up there, and some of the people I did, and I'm not criticising them at all, because I cry at the news, and I cried today. I cried at the Woman of the Year lunch today, and I think it is probably a bit about me too. But when I was there and there were people crying, part of me just thought, these people who are here now, like, your tears are not helping them, and actually they're being really, really strong. They have been through so much, and they're sitting there holding it together. And actually, rather than crying, like, just sit there, look at it, absorb how awful the situation is, and do something positive. Find a way to help.
A friend of mine went on a charity trip recently, actually, with, I think they're called One World or One, but it was to, I think it was to somewhere in Africa, but basically the people there just said, you're going to see some things today, do not cry in front of the, do not cry, because it's actually quite offensive.
Can you imagine someone basically seeing you?
Imagine someone coming to your flat and turning up crying.
No, but also, there's a kind of like, it's feeling worth sorry it. For people. Like, misery tourism. Yeah. Which, and again, it's very difficult, because I'm not saying they're bad people. They're not going, I'm an evil person who's going to do this thing. It does come from a good place, but it's still the wrong thing. And it still involves us and them and superiority. I think with all those kind of, I find it, even when a celebrity dies, right, I instantly shut down, because I feel like there's such ownership. It's like, even if it's they haven't met the person, it's like, my first experience of watching this person on the television,
I'm heartbroken. I'm so heartbroken.
And this person for me was the person, or, oh no, not this person. And I find all of it, the collectiveness of it, I actually find really scary. Like, it's like group think in Orwell. Like, there's something about it where I feel like Twitter's like shouting out of the window. Like, be careful. Like, what would you shout? Yeah. What would you actually shout out to everyone to hear? Like, I'm having a nice chocolate cake. To Jim, like, all these things. And I think the same about when people die.
Ricky Gervais always says it's like shouting into a bin.
Oh yeah, well, that's Nick Cohen said that. He said it about shouting to a bucket. Your opinion. Yeah, but so shouting to a bucket.
Do you think it's a bit narcissistic that that's our reaction sometimes? Like, I mean, I know it's well meaning, but when I saw a lot of things after the Manchester bombing was, I was at that arena.
How recently?
Last week.
No, but that is making it about you. And I think what you were saying there about, you know, when famous people die, sometimes it does affect you. So like, I know this is like probably the same for almost everyone listening to this, but when Bowie died, like I was genuinely like, because I've just grown up loving him, admiring him, listening to his music. But I think there's a big difference between going on social media and going like, I can't believe it, the world has lost an icon, you know, thinking of his family and friends at this time, and going, I'm so heartbroken because, also, I remember my first time when I heard the music and they did this to me, and I just think you're right. I mean, it's like that making it about you is a bit of narcissism.
I don't like the people who then say on social media, I wish everyone would stop doing it, because I also would never do that. Like, I also understand that in terms of actually when you are heartbroken and it's someone you don't know, you also want to just talk to other people about it and say, it's just this and I'm putting it out there, and then they come back. So I also have no right to be annoyed, but I do think there's competitive empathy. I think sometimes, so my thing isn't that pray for hashtag, it's when people do petitions on Facebook, because that's one of my very
the kind of click and that's
add your name to it, and there's certain people who do lots of them, and I think it doesn't make people engage with issues properly. I feel like proper conversations of going to work going, oh, did you know there's this man on death row? And actually he's this, and actually Theresa May's never asked him back, and actually Boris Johnson's. But if you actually talk to people, then... But I think those petitions, that's my one where I think you think you've done something.
Yeah.
And it's not... Which doesn't mean they shouldn't exist, It's not, I'm such a good person, I've done 3 petitions today.
So what do you think the social media etiquette should be when something horrendous happens? Because I find it's really difficult when you're in this industry where like you do need to like promote your work and do this and shout about that. You know, do you go on a 3-day silence? Do you put, like on Instagram, there was the trend of putting a blank picture up to show that you're like not posting.
I think so, like you said there, like everyone processes it differently, and if you do genuinely feel touched by the loss of someone you didn't know, or by a tragedy, that, you know, no one should tell you off for that.
No.
But I do think like just kind of thoughtlessly putting hashtag pray for this, which isn't really... doesn't feel like there's much thought, and not adding an
action. Sometimes it's so lazy, it's just like, oh my god, just heard, pray for, and actually it feels flippant.
And I do that, thinking of the family. I just feel like saying something is better, but then do you think it's like, you know, not to like, you know, plug what you've done, but you started a hashtag, help refugees, and it helped refugees.
Yeah, and it was, you know, that kind of happened by accident in a way, and people linked into that. But I do think, like, it kind of goes back to what you were saying, Sarah, and I don't want to criticise people, because some people are, you know, do believe in God, and they do believe that by praying for someone it will help. And I actually had a friend who offered for something recently that happened to me and said, you know, would you mind if I pray for you? And she actually wanted to actually pray, and I said, absolutely not. Like, you know, and who knows? Like, I'm open-minded, and maybe it'll help.
Yeah.
But it's I think it goes back to what you said about adding on to it, what to do. Yeah. So it's like... you know, and maybe people, for example, in Grenfell Tower, when that awful fire was happening, maybe some of them are religious and would actually appreciate people praying for them.
Yeah.
But say pray for them, and what can I do to help?
Because you're right, if I pray, if you don't have any religion, it's like, I've got lots of friends that are into crystals, and it's like if they were doing hashtag rose quartz for Grenfell, like, which some people in Grenfell would be like, but lovely, because everything's burned.
I think the thing that's always about the people who are going through it, isn't it? It's you have to think in your head,
and actually,
about the people in that crisis, not about you and what's going to make you feel better, but what's going to help them.
And also maybe like maybe there's also it's levels like a trifle. So you have 5 million people saying hashtag pray for, 1 million donating a fiver, 200,000 getting more involved, and then you have an actual kind of 2,000 people really literally doing things, but they're kind of propelled by the energy of the whole country is looking at you. And I guess that's what we get with social media now, which before we didn't. Like, you had the World Cup and Princess Diana's wedding, but there weren't collective events like this.
And this is why I feel like it's very easy to tweet and feel like you've done something, because it's there and it's just like press enter and it's posted and you've done something. And this is why I feel like with voting, I don't know how you feel about this, but I can't wait for the day where we can vote online, because the amount of young people who are tweeting and posting and Facebooking and Snapchatting, but they're probably not going down to the ballot office because, you know, it's weird to write on a piece of paper. And I hope young people are. I know that the numbers are increasing, but I feel like if you matched up the amount of tweets about politics to the actual votes, I think there'd be a massive disparity.
Absolutely,
But it's becoming more and more elaborate. But maybe the whole prayful thing. There's lots of like artists' drawings that get shared on social media, and it's like beautiful imagery and beautiful pictures. But like you say, that's not helping.
But you know what? There are some that I think have been really strong, and there's some that, again, I'm probably doing it, probably crying for me, not them, but that have, like, hashtags that have started out of tragedy that have really, like, touched me, made me cry. So, like, for example, I think something, I'm trying to remember what exactly it was, but it happened in Australia. I think there was a terrorist attack, and there were Muslim women in particular who were saying that they felt nervous to travel on the tube because they were feeling like they were going to be victimized or attacked. Just for being Muslim, and people started a hashtag. I think it was "I'll ride with you," and it was people basically. It started with someone genuinely saying, like, "If you're feeling scared, if you want to travel, if you want to get on the bus, tell me where to meet you, and I will ride with you and protect you." And that started trending, and that was beautiful. And again, there's these open door ones. You know, if you need a cup of tea, my door's open. And I think that's
those are the things. I think that's what's interesting. What actually what you're saying isn't. There's no problem with hashtags. There's no problem with communal outpouring of emotion. There's no problem with us things where they're far away. But it's about don't be lazy with it.
Be thoughtful.
You're just going
and be thoughtful of the people going through it.
The trouble with that,
it.
That hashtag is sometimes it seems like I don't know how engaged you are, whether you just want everyone to go like tick, I've done it. I always think that about wearing poppies as well, because I think some people really, really, really care about the issues of what the poppy charity does and stuff. But it's weird on TV, they don't let you go on without a poppy. If you're a pacifist, you still have to wear one. And if you don't wear one, you get really, really angry men with flags in their pictures, like shouting at you about why. So, and I've always had a thing where I don't want to wear a poppy because I really, really don't believe in killing people from other countries, but I do donate to charities that support older people, so I feel like that's my thing. But they don't let you not wear them.
That's
like,
really
have I got news for you and stuff? You have to wear it, and you just have this huge conversation. They go, it's basically costume, and you have to wear it because they don't want to get the flak if you haven't.
Wow! So you could have done something like you have actually done something else.
I've just thought about it and gone, we just do these things thoughtlessly, and it's not to take away anyone who's conscripted into the war, but I personally don't. We kill people from other countries. It's murder. It's legitimised murder. And this is why I wouldn't be a good Prime Minister. Because we would be completely defenceless. But it's I've had a thought out thing, whereas it's just quicker to go, it's too quick, and you stick your poppy on. And
so it's about...
So interesting.
So it's about being thoughtful about things, basically, is what it comes down to. It's about
thinking. I think there's stuff now that means that we too quickly we can go, yep, bib, I press the button.
Yeah. Because I was reading something the other day about George Michael, because there's a new documentary out, and he donated to charity a lot, and Kirsty Young has come out recently saying, like, he never told anyone all of these charities he donated to, but I'm going to say on his behalf all of this money that he's donated, because I feel like I want people to know that about my friends.
And he bought that woman. Do you remember that he saw there was a woman on Deal or No Deal, and she didn't win the money. She said she wanted it for IVF, and he anonymously gave it to her. And she only found out after he died.
Also, in this interview that Kirsty Young did, like the last interview he did, I think it was. She was saying how much he loved TV because he invited like Richard and Judy to his parties and stuff.
Really?
But it's really amazing, and also loved Kirsty Young through like watching her on TV. They became friends. But I just thought there's something really interesting in that. Like, do we need to do more things anonymously and just feel like why do we need to put it on Instagram? Why can't we just donate?
There was a time and there was some people sleeping rough, and I'd left work in Leicester Square, and it was late. And I found that there was a number you can call for, I think it's the
Street
Mungos.
Some Mungos.
And they will potentially come and find a person. And
so I did that. Street Link, but it's under St Mungo's charity, and that's what they always want. Anyone who's actually rough sleeping, they come at 9 in the morning. So that's the time. And if they've moved, unfortunately.
And they'll let them know that there's a place to
find them somewhere.
So I did that. I sat in my car and I called the number, and I told them, I said, there's people sleeping here, etc. And then I thought about it, and I was like, should I post about that? Because I feel like sharing that number, and I also felt like I've got quite a lot of followers, and maybe if I say, look, take the time to do this, you know, it took me 30 seconds to do it, will that encourage other people? I do know what you're saying.
I don't have a problem with the people posting it, but I have other friends who are so angry because they feel like, well, we're virtue signalling is what they call it. Whereas, and also sometimes I just feel like we despise it in other people because it makes us feel bad, because when we go, God, I've been walking past a lot and looking upwards or going, all these things we do, because it actually makes us go, I'm vegan, and you get such a negative reaction from some people because they instantly feel you're telling them off, and you know, you haven't said anything, but it's that as well.
But then don't you think, like, virtue signalling? Yeah. Like, I was actually thinking that today, it's so weird, but I was thinking, like, it can be a bit annoying sometimes, but actually the end result of it can be like, so you, for example, Sarah, you've got loads of followers, Emma, you've got loads of followers, and by doing a bit of virtue signalling, some of your followers might feel inspired to do something good, and as long as the end result is that somebody gets help,
I love
who
it.
Cares?
Catherine Moran always says she's like on being famous. Like, I'm not, but you know, followers is I guess a good thing. But she was saying that loads of people would tweet, oh, I've just seen Kat Moran getting a sandwich at Tesco, or just seen Kat Moran like in a pub.
Yeah.
And she was like, well, I'm going to use that as in, oh, I've just seen Kat Moran help the old lady down an escalator.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I've just seen Kat Moran give a £20 note to a homeless person. And she was like, that's one good thing actually about virtue signalling, like in a way, is people are going to see you do it.
Yeah. And they might go, I should do it.
I like that she said that.
And also, again, I think it's a shame. I think any politician in London should be utterly ashamed of themselves, how many people are sleeping rough, mm-hmm. and how much more it's got. And I don't know anyone who isn't heartbroken by it. Yeah. Like, as in, but they think we don't care because they don't see anything being done.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's the other thing. If they go, oh, these things are trending, or mm-hmm. people are discussed, that's, mm-hmm. I do think it's important.
And again, yeah. like what we were saying earlier about the Pray For hashtag. Mm-hmm. If you make it about the person who needs the help, so the vulnerable yeah. person as opposed to mm. about you, like if you're virtue signalling left, right and centre mm. and looking like, you know,
yeah.
the holier than thou mm. person, do you think the homeless person getting the sandwich gives a shit about no. whether you virtue signal or no. not? If 10 mm. other people are then going to give them sandwiches yes. and help yeah. them out, they don't give a shit about whether you're showing off or not.
I did, basically, one of my friends, she works, you know, she sings in the choir at St. Martin's, so she works near Leicester Square a lot. She was talking a lot to a homeless man, and she bought him a tent, which is really great, not virtue signalling. She bought a man a tent, and then he died in it on New Year's Eve, and he's 52. And she found out because his son was using the tent, and she thought he'd stolen it. We did a gig with homeless organisations because we did a Q&A in the middle, so like everyone has so many questions about what to do, and yeah. we don't know. And these two charities basically said, you see, someone's sleeping rough, report it. There are beds for rough sleepers, but they have to be. But there's actual stuff, and they didn't say don't give them money. If you want to give them money, give them money.
Okay, so Sarah, as you were saying, yeah. if you do see someone sleeping rough, seeing as we've been talking about mm. it a lot, and we've been talking mm. about giving people routes to take action yeah. rather than just talking about it, what they recommend at Mungo's is that you go to either the StreetLink website, or you can actually go onto iTunes or Play Store and download an app called the StreetLink app. And then you can let them know where a person is sleeping rough, and they will go out and talk to them and mm. offer them some help. Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. So you pin it on the map, essentially.
Yeah, they ask you a few questions and all that kind of stuff, and then they go around.
Amazing. Well, I feel lighter.
Yeah,
me too.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank
Sarah.
You so much.
It's been so lovely to chat to you. Anything you've got coming up, Sarah, that you want to talk about?
I'm doing my show Lads, Lads, Lads in the West End in January.
And I've seen it in Edinburgh. It's amazing.
Thank you.
We'll all be coming along to see you in January then. Sarah, yeah.
thank you so much.
Thank you so much. For enlightening us and discussing with us.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode. Episode 6 of Get It Off Your Breast. Time is going very quickly, and we hope you've enjoyed the series so far. We really enjoyed that. Got a bit deep in places, but also some light relief, obviously with Sarah being an amazing comedian. And if you want to rate and review us, we would love that. It helps so much people discover us in the iTunes charts. So please leave a little review and see you next week. We will be joined by the amazing Munro Bergdorf. We actually will this time. I know that I think we mentioned it in the last episode, but really excited to share that episode. You won't want to miss it.